In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Eric Wargo about his book, Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self. It's a wonderful book, and I would like to start in an unusual way before welcoming Eric by reading a passage from it briefly to sort of set the scene for what we'll be talking about over the course of this interview. Eric writes, "I see the long self revolution as a revolution of imagination and one of care, of empathy, and anti-cruelty. When you directly experience your own self as a vast and sublime and unique four-dimensional formation in the block universe, you realize that every fellow traveler on this planet is similarly vast and sublime and unique, like threads in a tapestry, both irreducibly individual and completely independent." And now, let's go on to Dreamland.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Welcome to Dreamland. We're talking today to a guest we've had before, and it was very interesting. Eric Wargo is with us, and you can tell by his innocent smile that he is just a nice, ordinary guy who doesn't go move through time or anything like that. Well, not quite. We're going to have a fascinating day today with Eric, I'm sure, because he has written a book called Precognitive Dreamworks and the Long Self. Two other Dreamlanders have praised the book to the skies. Mitch Horowitz, who is on with us often and was the editor who brought the key to the general public, says, "Eric Wargo is a new kind of intellectual whose refinement has emerged from his thoughtful response to the dogmatism that opposes new queries in science." Yes, yes. And Jeffrey Krapel, my dear friend, author of Supernatural, has said, "Here is the book for which I have been waiting, a paranormal practice manual to recommend to readers who ask for one thing, a practice, a way to cultivate their own superhuman capacities." Well, yeah, Eric, and welcome to Dreamland.
Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's a pleasure, as always. We've always had such a good time. Just to fill you in a little further, folks, Eric doesn't drop down to us from the skies with no credentials whatsoever. He has a PhD in anthropology from Emory University. He's a professional science writer and editor in Washington, D.C. We interviewed him for his marvelous book, Time Loops, and subscribers, you must go back into the archive and listen to that interview. It is really brain-bending, and I think this one will be too. His blog is The Nightshirt. Okay. All right. Now, I'm always interested when I'm interviewing somebody like you who is in the middle of a long and extraordinary life journey. Where do I start? And I thought that the place to start would be to ask you, and this will be the foundation, folks, of much of our discussion, what is what you call the block universe? Let's define that first, and then we can, because I, from my reading of the book, all of this emerges out of that reality in some way. So tell us what it is.
Right. Well, the block universe is nothing new. It is essentially the cosmology that was discovered by Albert Einstein well over a century ago now. His discoveries about, you know, his thought experiments about, you know, trains on parallel tracks.
Right. Relativity.
It led to his discoveries about light as the sort of universal speed limit and so forth. and the fact of relativity that there's no universal reference frame. Well, counterintuitively, what that led to was the realization that time and space are not separate things. They're part of the same continuum, is the word that was used at the time, the space-time continuum. And the time is the fourth dimension. It's just another dimension of space. And we see this every day. We experience it every day as gravity. Gravity is the bending of the three dimensions of space into the fourth dimension, time. And at certain limits, such as a black hole, the surface of a black hole, you know, space entirely bends away, angles away from the three dimensions that we sort of are familiar with and becomes time. The implication of that is that if time is a dimension, just like the three dimensions of space, then even though we experience time in a single direction, we experience ourselves as moving just in one direction along this continuum or along this dimension, you could theoretically move backwards. And that means that the past is still exists somewhere, you know? I mean, we can look, when we look out into space, we're looking into the past, literally.
Right.
And by the same token, we are already in the past to other observers out in the universe. And that essentially means that there is a future, that our future already exists too. That the future and past all exist. And the way you can visualize this, Bloch universe, that's sort of the way it's been phrased. And it's a handy term. It means that just imagine a big four-dimensional space-time block. And you can't, of course, imagine those four dimensions. So you kind of collapse it into three. Just get rid of one of the space dimensions and pretend your three-dimensional brick, you know, is two dimensions of space and one dimension of time. And that time dimension, you know, our lives are sort of, we're actually worms. We're actually worms that live, you know, for a certain number of decades through that time dimension. And what we experience as the present moment is the cross section of that block, that space-time block. But our reality is four-dimensional. We are four-dimensional creatures. Our future is ahead of us. Our future is already there in that block universe. We don't know it really. We can't directly perceive it, but it's there. And just as our past is still there. So that's the block universe. And the implication then for our lives is the term that I use, the long self in the
book. But you know, it's in Ecclesiastes, it's referred to as the long home, the long shadow of the self, of the soul that sweeps back across time through many lives, one would assume, and leaves one wondering what we are. And one of the first things my wife said after she passed away and came back was, it's all a game. A game. And there was I had another thing happen years and years ago, when I had a sort of failed contact experience, but a very physical one with these entities I call the visitors. They called out to me to come and meet with them in the woods early one morning. And I was afraid and went back to the house. And as I sat on the bedside, someone was there that I couldn't see. And I was suddenly plunged back into my babyhood and relived as if it was happening again, the moment when I first began to walk. And it was astonishingly detailed in every, it was that moment, with the difference that it was this adult mind in that baby body. And as if it was a communication saying, you're an infant, but you are starting to walk. And isn't that kind of what we are? Isn't that how you see us? We're just starting to walk.
That's one way of seeing it, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an amazing experience. And in the book, I describe other people's experiences similarly. Philip K. Dick, of course.
Yes. Well, Philip K. Dick and I are joined at the hip somehow. Yeah. I don't know. Both of us obsessed with Rome. Both of us have similar experiences. And we shared for years the same agent. Dick had already died, and I didn't. I just went to to that agent for other reasons, and it turned out he had been Dick's agent, and so we had a lot in common. But yeah, go ahead. Some of these other cases that are similar. That's why I brought that one up, because so go ahead.
No, I the more I've studied Philip K. Dick, the more I think Whitley Strieber he's like, they're like twins. You're like, it at first somehow.
Right. Yeah, I guess no one will make any of my books into movies until after I'm dead either, which is annoying.
Well, you've had a few. You've actually.
I had a few sort of semi misfires. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, The Hunger was pretty good. The Wolfen was fair. Superstorm was good as far as it went. Communion, they didn't have enough money to make that right. So, but anyway, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about this experiential aspect of your work. Because as Jeff Kripal points out, practice is very important here. But before we do that, folks, Free Dreamlanders, listen up. You're going to watch and listen to some commercials.
You know, we live right now in a time of great upheaval and personal loneliness and also dread. The dread comes from the fact that we've been taught that we are only material bodies, and therefore we're terrified of death as never before. But it's not true. And in my book, Jesus, A New Vision, I look at this in a completely new way, not through the lens of Christianity and not through the lens of secularism either. By exploring the life of Jesus and his teachings in this new way, Jesus, A New Vision sheds fresh light on the meaning and power of his life, his parables. It explores the mysteries of the Gospels of Thomas and Mary with fresh insight, and it explains why he did what he did, which was to commit suicide by crucifixion. Then it goes into what the Shroud of Turin really is. It is not a medieval forgery. Something extraordinary happened in that tomb. To find out, read Jesus, A New Vision. It is truly a first.
It's available on Amazon as a Kindle, as a paperback, and on Audible and Amazon and Apple Books as an audiobook read by me. Get it today. Contact in the Desert 2021, the journey continues.
When you start to ask the question, it unfolds the fabric of space itself, how it's made, what is it made of?
We're not alone in this universe. We never have been.
Alien intelligences have cohabited with us on this planet for millions of years.
We inherited the obsession from the Anunnaki.
Anyone that still thinks that we're the ones that are obsessed with gold does not know enough about the true history of our species, how we came to be here,
and the conditions that brought us here.
We are not unique in this universe. Extraterrestrials do exist. We are, so to say, the copies of them.
Contact in the Desert 2021 goes virtual. Go to contactinthedesert.com to find out more.
We're talking to Eric Wergo. His book, Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self, Interpreting Messages from the Future. And I'm going to kind of circle back to where we were in a funny way by asking you who you think you are.
I think I am. You know, it's funny. I'm, you know, there are two answers to that question, as to any profound question. One, I'm nobody. I mean, and here's something that I think we have in common is a history of Zen practice.
Yeah, essentially Zen practice in my case. Yeah.
Yeah. And my own practice has, you know, led over the years to exactly where it's supposed to lead, you know, where it says on the packaging it will lead, which is, you know, there's really nothing real about, you know,
this. Self. Yeah. Right. It is a game. Anne was right.
But on the other hand, the other side to it is that something about our reductive, you know, you can use the word materialist. I don't kind of like that term as an epithet so much, but you know, there's something about our reductive culture that denies the reality of the self in a bad way, you know, that encourages a sort of clinging to kind of this ephemeral momentary self, but gets us to forget about the fact that we have a past and that we have a future. And the value, I think, of the ultimate value of precognitive dream work, getting in touch with your precognition via dreams, is awakening to that long self, and yourself has this incredible vastness and value to it. And when you realize that it is this immense, you know, sublime formation, you know, in the block universe, you know, even just, we're talking material birth to death of the material body, even just that, you know, I don't even get into, you know, anything larger, but even just that is amazing. And when you can connect to that in a palpable way, you know, via your dreams, and there's other ways of connecting to it too, but the dreams are the easiest. It vastly increases your sense of the value of yourself. So on the one hand, I'm nobody, but I'm also a long self, as are you, as is everyone. And when we can awaken to that the length of ourselves and how they intertwine, I find it a sublime, very spiritual. Yeah,
the parts of Ecclesiastes which refer to the long home are one of among the most haunting words ever written, because we are haunted. We are haunted by ourselves. Now, the block universe theory, there are two components, two different approaches to it. One approach is time itself is like a wave front moving forward, and experiences are happening on this wave front and in a sense being frozen in a block which is behind the wave front. But you can travel back into the block like that happened to me, and I think it happens to us all after we die, and examine in absolutely extraordinary detail essentially everything that ever has been. It's amazing. Now, the other one, I think, is the one you believe, which is consciousness is not a wave front, but a kind of a pulsation or a wave going through a medium of reality that is already in some way formed prior to the moment of presence reaching it. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's true. I don't subscribe to the view that is often attributed to physics, to quantum physics, that it's held widely by sort of outsiders to physics, which is that somehow consciousness or awareness somehow collapses that wave function, that wave front, and makes reality. I don't subscribe to that. I do think And I think a lot of physicists would be in agreement with me that the future already exists there. Our consciousness is kind of moving through it. But it's, yeah, like you said, it's already out there. And one of the challenges I have in my writing and whenever I talk about this is people hear that and they find it very off-putting. People in our culture, we have this sensitivity around the idea of the future already existing. You know, we want to somehow change it, you know, even though we don't know where it is.
We want to believe we have free will. I do.
Right,
I know.
Right. But it's a Western hangup. You know, it's very much bound with our beliefs about individualism and so on. And I don't think it's such a hang-up for other cultures in the world. And honestly, my Zen practice, you know, my most blissful, you know, epiphanies in Zen meditation or after a period of Zen meditation are all about essentially about the block universe. It's about like, I'm part of this big, like inevitable motion. You know, but it has this blissful feeling. It's a blissful, empowering feeling. And I think I say at some point in the book, you know, for a Zen master, you know, the less free you imagine you are, the more free you feel. There's kind of an imprisonment in that clinging to that belief in free will. And when we sort of get rid of it, it's immensely empowering and you feel actually free. But you have to get rid of the belief in it first. My kind of hidden agenda, I think, in my both of my books has been to kind of smuggle this kind of Zen perspective into, you know, this book about an ostensibly paranormal phenomenon, because that's where these experiences have led me, really.
Well, paranormal, outside of the normal, in this case, really means not understood.
Yeah.
Not un-understandable.
Right.
I have thought a lot about this business of what Anne said. I mean, she first said it's a game. And I found that very disturbing for all of the reasons you just outlined. And yet at the same time, looking at this, as the body is a processor of space-time, it is not necessarily making its present so much as absorbing its present as if it was always new. In other words, it's a kind of a machine. And then you add to that, it has entertainment value, and you think to yourself, what are we doing here? Are we here for the fun of pretending that we don't know the future and living in a state of kind of excitement? And this gets me to the material that you discuss briefly in the book. I think it's about 241. Let me just look. A possession experience you had. Possessed by your future. Can you, out-of-body experience, lucid dreams, and sleep paralysis, can you speak to that whole level of experience now? I think it's the right time.
Yeah, well, among the paranormal experiences that I had had in my life that just hadn't made sense until I started studying psychic phenomena and precognition specifically, were a couple of, well, at that point, just one, I think, two out-of-body experiences. But that's what they'd be called now. But this one that I described in the book also felt like possession. It felt like I was both, you know, I was clearly sitting in a reality that was not where my physical form happened to be at that time. I was, you know, I was sitting in my study, whereas I was actually sleeping in bed. But I also felt like this was something compelled by an external presence, a force that I couldn't resist. And I thought it was it somehow seemed to be emanating in my thoughts. It was forcing me to do things, and this force was somehow emanating from Papua New Guinea, which is a place I had spent a few months several years before, and I had some associations to that place, that very exotic island, including, you know, a strange experience with a sort of local shaman there. And so I immediately interpreted this as some kind of possession. I was being possessed maybe by this, a shaman or whatever you want to call it, a healer, you know, in that community, you know, all the way across the world. But when I woke up, you know, I'm in my bed, and my wife shakes me awake. She says, Eric, you're snorting like a pig. What's going on? And, you know, and I wake up, oh my God, I'm in my bed. You know, the fear is gone. Oh, thank God. Yeah, that was like terrifying. But I got out of bed. Went into my study, and like, it was all exactly as it had been, you know, and I sat in my desk chair just as I had been sitting in this out of body experience or whatever. In fact, and I did the physical actions that I had done just to kind of confirm, you know, I did the things that I had felt compelled to do in that experience of my own free will. I sat there and did them. And of course nothing happened. It was just, I was just sitting in my study kind of feeling silly, you know, going through these motions. But it was only, you know, much later, you know, after I started, this was back in 1998, I think, something like that. And it was well over a decade later that I started studying precognition and thinking about precognitive dreams as how they relate to events often in your very near future, and that some of them can be almost video quality in the sense that you're actually experiencing some physical, you know, something in your actual environment, but it's in a dream state. And so you think it's an out of body experience, but you're in your body. It's just in your future. You know, it's again, one of these time slip almost experiences like you were describing, although in this case over a span of, you know, maybe a few minutes, not a span of, you know, a whole lifetime. But anyway, the key for me was, unfortunately, I've written all this down in my journal, so I did have a strict record of it. But what I realized was that my wife said, "You're snorting like a pig." Well, that's my first association to the word pig is Papua New Guinea, because everything there revolves around pigs, and everything smells like a barbecue restaurant, really, because of, you know, the kind of pigs constantly being smoked and so forth. And I realized, oh, this was a very vivid precognitive dream, essentially, of me being, it was not out of body. I was in body, but I was in my body, my long body. You know, I was in my long body 20 minutes after the dream, sitting in another room of my house, going through the motions that I was going through in my dream, this time freely willed. And it felt like this evil possession, because at that time I was like a closed circuit, you know, video camera of my body. I mean, if you're, you know, viewers and listeners know the film Being John Malkovich.
Yes.
You know, a classic, you know, he goes into the mind into the body of John Malkovich. And at first, you know, he's a puppeteer, so he learns to control John Malkovich's puppet body. But initially, he has no control. And so he's just like looking through the eyes of John Malkovich. Well, I think I was looking through my own eyes, but at a different point in time. So I think a lot of lucid dream kinds of experiences are really precognitive experiences where we're kind of slipping, you know, our consciousness is kind of slipping ahead in that timeline, that long self, that long body, or whatever you want to call it.
You know, we're moving into the age of Aquarius, in which the water carrier pours out the waters of the earth. And I have for about 5 years been having flood dreams of unbelievable power. Some of them are so powerful they happen during waking hours. And free dreamlanders, when we get back, we're going to talk about how do we identify whether or not a given dream or group of dreams is precognitive. We're talking to Eric Wargo, his book, Precognitive Dreamworks and the Long Self. His website, it's not, you don't really have a website, or do you have a website?
I have a blog, yeah.
Yeah, the blog is The Nightshirt. How do we get to The Nightshirt?
You type in thenightshirt, all one word, .com.
Okay, well, that's simple enough. Meet him, get to know him on thenightshirt.com. We'll be right back.
Support unknowncountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
Linda Moulton Howe has appeared many, many times on Dreamland. 85 shows in total. It is a literal treasure trove of amazing Linda Moulton Howe material. Listen to this excerpt from November the 8th, 2013, of an interview she did with an officer from Ellsberg Air Force Base talking about a UFO incident that took place there. As we listen in, she is just asking him about a guard who woke up in a field, unable to explain how he got there.
When he became conscious and found himself in the field, his gun was off to the side of his body.
It was in the mud.
You do not think he had two shoes and socks off?
You know, he started walking towards the lights that were reflecting up close. He didn't know what the lights were, but he was going that way because that's where it was light. After he started walking, he realized that one of his boots was missing.
Huh.
It was a fully laced combat boot, which was not a zipper type, so it had to have been taken off.
You can listen to the rest of this interview and so much more. Linda Moulton Howe material, all kinds of extraordinary material on unknowncountry.com, plus meditations, all kinds of experiences, Whitley Strieber audiobooks. It's a really rich treasury of material, unlike anything else in the world. Get involved in unknowncountry.com. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
We're talking to Eric Wargo. His two books, Time Loops, which was a brain bender and a half, we talked about on Dreamland a couple of years ago, I guess. And subscribers, you can go to the archive and just put in Eric Wargo's name, W-A-R-G-O, and you can listen to this wonderful interview. And free Dreamlanders, why don't you do it too? All you have to do is sign up, and you can do that and so much more. We've got so much in this show, in this archive. This is truly a treasure of almost of epic proportions on the internet. All right, Eric. Now, let's go back to the question I asked just before we left, sort of semi-left the air. We didn't really leave the air. We were staring at each other the entire time, but you folks didn't see that. How do we tell if a dream is precognitive? Because these dreams have been horrendous and just terribly frightening. Like there's one of them where I hear loud noises outside in this apartment, which is about half a mile from the Pacific Ocean and at an elevation of 70 feet. So, you know, if there's going to be a tsunami or something, we're definitely going to notice it here very quickly. And I've even gone so far as to analyze the Santa Monica Bay and the way the continental shelf drops off and so forth. And let's put it this way: if a tsunami comes into that bay, this area is gone. Period. Now, I hear what happens is I hear crashing noises in the dream, which it repeats, and I realize they're crashing and splashing. And I go to the front door, the glass doors over the balcony. It's just as realistic as it can be. And these huge drops of water are slamming down, and they just get bigger and bigger, and they come roaring in a wall into the apartment, and that's it. And what's happened is this storm, something has happened, and this huge wall of water has appeared out of nowhere. There's others that happen in different parts of the country. I've been having them for about 10 years, and I know many people who have these. What is this about? Do you have them by any chance?
No, not flood dreams. I haven't. I had one many, many years ago, about 20 years ago, like a tidal wave, but not. I haven't had those. I don't know. That's the thing with precognitive dream work. You can't really know a dream is precognitive until the event comes to pass. I mean, you can often get hints. You know, a lot of dreams hint at something profound coming, and you can kind of sense, yeah, this is going to turn out to be something real. But then, even in those cases, it's always turns out to be real. The reality of the dream is always very unpredictable in some way. People often have very like dreams about disasters that, the event that seemed like a disaster in the dream comes true, but it actually was something not a disaster at all, or even something good. And so how can you tell a dream is precognitive? Well, I've got two answers. One, I think all dreams are precognitive. That's not something I could prove, but it's a hunch. Based on my research, I think that all dreams at least contain precognitive material, you know, material that consists of symbolic representations of events or experiences, I should say, and thoughts and preoccupations in our own future. That said, how can you identify the reality that a precognitive dream relates to? And that's very hard. One thing though, and I talk about this in the book, you can, precognitive dreams that turn out to be distinctly precognitive often have certain tags, associated with them. One of them is what I call time gimmicks. If you sort of like live through an experience and you realize, oh, I dreamed about that, and maybe go back to your dream journal and say, yeah, my God, this is, you know, I dreamed about this, you know, 3 days ago, whatever. Often those dreams, or in my case, is almost always those dreams contain some little element having to do with time travel, having to do with some sort of anachronism, some sort of juxtaposition of old and new, or looking in a rearview mirror is a common one. Something suggesting symbolically that idea of traveling in time. I've got a million examples of this from my own dream journal and from other people's dream journals that I've worked with. So, you know, if there's time travel in your dream, or you dream about a time travel movie, or there's something, or if you're, you know, free associating on your dream, it reminds you of, you know, Doctor Who, or, you know, some kind of time travel narrative, pay attention to that dream, because it may turn out indeed to relate to an experience in your head in time. But like I said, dreams that feel calamitous or seem calamitous often aren't, ultimately.
I mean, that's a relief.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a universal principle. I mean, there are, you know, different dreamers dream differently. And, for instance, you and I, both know Elizabeth Krohn, who.
Yeah. I was just going to mention her.
Right. I mean, she, you know, has a habit. I don't know if she's had these dreams recently, but She, you know, she dreamed regularly about disasters that she would read about in the news. And she would see essentially the scene that she would then see in the news media, you know, a few days later about a plane crash or some other disaster like that. And so, some disaster dreams are, you know, they are foretelling.
Happening. Yeah. Folks, we had her on Dreamland. It's KROHN. Yeah. Do look her up and listen to that Dreamland because it's worth listening to. But let me talk a little bit more about her and that. Let the listeners know what happened to her. She was struck by lightning. She was basically a normal person. And she was struck by lightning and nearly killed. In fact, she left her body and didn't realize she had been struck by lightning. And was walking into church with her two sons, and no one seemed to notice her, was aware of her existence. And the boys were terribly upset about something, and she noticed this heap of clothes in the parking lot and went over to see what it was, and it was her body. And then she started to leave. She was dead. And was told that she could return if she wanted to, and she wanted to raise her boys. And she was told it would be very, very painful, but she could return and recover. And she did that. And then she was kind of unstuck. And this is what I want to talk about next. This sense, this being unstuck. It happened to Damian Brinkley the same way. Also struck by lightning. Being unstuck, she would. One of the plane crash incidents was a plane that crashed in a French airliner that crashed into the South Atlantic at night. And she actually was in the plane, talking to this poor woman who was there with her five-year-old son, who was begging her to take her son out. And I have been aware of the fact that there are certain situations where a person cannot leave. In other words, this woman and this child were doomed and they could not leave. And therefore, she could be with them and see them. I had a similar experience happen to me once when I was at the Monroe Institute, and a friend who was dying showed up and did the whole week-long gateway with me. And when I got back to New York, he had just died, and his wife said he had become unable to talk and kept getting up and sliding around in the bed. And what was so weird about that is, at the gateway in Reston, Virginia, he looked like he was kind of gliding around in a little scooter. And he could not talk, therefore he could never tell anyone of his experience of that gateway. And the same thing with these two people in this plane. She's dying. She's got her little boy there. She's begging Elizabeth to take the child, and Elizabeth can't. But Elizabeth comes back the same way I did, with this memory. Now, is there some kind of hidden mechanism here, Eric, that is preventing us somehow from interrupting the fate of people? Because both of these incidents taken together tell me that you're right, that the universe is a fixed proposition.
Yeah, I mean, precognition couldn't exist if there wasn't a future.
Then why are we here? Why bother?
Well, that's the con, right?
Yeah.
That's what precognitive dreamwork really gives you, is the ultimate con. You know, it gives you this insoluble conundrum, and I can't pretend to have solved it, But I have had moments of kind of seeing into this mystery, you know, they're very blissful, and I can't bring them back and tell you what I saw exactly. It's just too, you know, it's too complicated, but it's profound, and it drives me on, because I think this is a koan I want to give people who are ready for this koan. I think this is what the nut we need to crack, you know, if we want to, you know, do what you're saying, you know, evolve to, you know, whether it's, I don't know, spiritually in terms of our society, whatever, we need to confront this big thing that's standing between us and something much bigger. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes a lot of sense. And I think it's very much directionally true that when Anne said it's a game, what she was saying was not that it's a funny, cute little game, but that it's a big game. And in this game, we are we're really playing for high stakes, but it's not that we are forming our future. Rather, that we are absorbing it with the more objective and the richer what happens to us, the more we gain from the time a body passes through the medium of reality. And you talk about Zen, I talk about the Gurdjieff work. There are so many different methodologies of basically enriching life experience, so that when you die and the body is finished, what you are left with is an immense richness of being. And not that you did anything good, bad, or indifferent, but that you did everything well and can look back upon your life with a truly merciful and objective vision of who you are and what you've done, or what you have been involved in, I should say. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And these are the kinds of thoughts that you start having sort of obsessively as you engage in this practice that I'm trying to sort of turn people onto. And as you're saying that, you know, that I think one of the ideas, or I don't know, presumptions that it calls into question, or that the concept of the long self calls into question, is it a matter of looking back on your life? You know, is the end of your life actually the end? Should we even be thinking in these terms of beginning, middle, and end? I mean, I've kind of enjoyed like trying to rethink that, you know, maybe, you know, especially I think that this past year with COVID has really, you know, one of the most sad, I think the saddest part of this past year has been all of the stories of people dying alone on ventilators and you know, unable to be with their loved ones. And
yeah.
this sense of the end of life has been almost, you know, it has been taken away, the dignity and the solemnity, I guess, of the end of life, which is supposed to be, you know, we ideally want, you know, to be, we don't want to die that way, you know. But I'm thinking, you know, maybe we shouldn't even think of death, you know, death as the end. You know, maybe death is actually part of the middle, and the end of our journey is somewhere in the middle of our life somewhere. And maybe it's not this beginning, middle, and end thing. That's part of this kind of this linear narrative that all of our Western concepts of time lead us to. But maybe that's part of what we need to get rid of. and that maybe, you know, is the end of my life something that happened, you know, when I was, you know, 30, and like is my birth actually something that happened when I was, you know, 40, and I, you know, who knows? I mean, but kind of re-scrambling this notion of our narrative,
the linear narrative.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very interesting idea, but I wonder if it's possible, in the sense that is reality about chaos? It doesn't seem to be. Would be very chaotic, I think.
No. I'm not talking about. I'm sort of thinking more. I guess my model for this is sort of nonlinear storytelling. You know, like, you know, we think of our lives often as a story with a beginning, middle, and end. But then, you know, a few decades ago, writers started playing with scrambling the sequence of things and telling stories out of order and creating a much more richer narrative kind of composition by playing with those, you know, those conventions about, you know, before and after. Maybe that's, you know, maybe that's how we should start to rethink ourselves, our biographies, by getting out of this mindset that the end, death is the end and the birth is the beginning. Maybe that's not how we should tell our stories to ourselves. But this is, I'm just sort of musing, you know, this is, this is for a future book.
Well, we are our stories, though.
Yeah, I'm just saying those stories could be told maybe in a different way.
In what way do you think would be better?
I don't know. I don't
that's
know.
That's why it's for another book.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go to a dream in January of 2018 that you mentioned in chapter 17, Look Back in Amber, excuse me, Time Gimmicks and Dream Paleontology. A dream in late 2018 excited me greatly. I found myself flying over what I knew was a prehistoric landscape toward a pair of mid-sized quadrupeds that seemed from a distance to be sauropods of some sort. Even better, it was a lucid dream. Can you take it from there?
Yeah, no, this is one of my favorite dream experiences. It was a lucid dream in which I can never control my flight in a lucid dream, but in my lucid dreams, I'm generally flying and I just sort of carried along wherever it takes me. And, but I was flying towards this hill and there were these prehistoric creatures. I was like, yes, you know, like they're going to be dinosaurs. Well, I landed between these two creatures and they weren't dinosaurs. I was kind of disappointed. They were kind of boring, kind of vaguely reptilian quadrupeds, maybe the size of crocodiles or bears, something like that. And one of them had saber teeth and it was kind of brown. And one of them was just kind of like this squat reptilian things with pebbly skin. And they were trying to attack each other. And I had to hold them at arms, you know.
You ended up in the middle.
Their muscles at arm's length and keep them from attacking each other. And as I did this, the creature on the left had a laser dot on its forehead. And I wanted to turn away to see who was pointing a laser at this creature, but I couldn't because I had to pay attention to what I was doing. Okay, well, so I wrote it down in detail, including that detail of the laser dot. And that evening, I came home from work and opened my mailbox. And what should I find but my first issue of a magazine that I had subscribed to several months earlier and forgotten about. The magazine is called Prehistoric Times. I love this magazine. It's a magazine about dinosaurs, but not paleontology really. It's about dinosaur art, dinosaur toys and collectibles, dinosaur culture, dinosaurs in movies. And I think of it as like a fan magazine for dinosaurs, okay? And I subscribed to it because I like to show dinosaur pictures to my young daughter. Well, anyway, the first issue that I'd gotten since subscribing was, you know, it was in my hands. Awesome. So I sat down with my daughter on the couch and we were reading through it. And on page, I think it was page 14, boom, there's a picture of the exact thing I dreamed. It was the exact scene I dreamed. The same hill, the same two creatures. And they're kind of approaching each other, you know. And I learned what the creatures were in the magazine and so on. And is like, you know, just unmistakable precognitive dream, you know. And except for there was that detail of the laser dot, okay. And this comes back to that thing we were talking about earlier of time gimmicks, okay, which sometimes clue you in that a dream is going to be precognitive. Well, I have many years' experience of Freudian dream interpretation behind me. I think that kind of helped in my study of precognition, even before I got interested in the subject. I was used to sort of just free associating on the elements of my dreams to see what they reminded me of. And just immediately, that laser dot on reflection reminded me of the scene in The Terminator when Arnold Schwarzenegger approaches Linda Hamilton in a crowded bar, and he advances on her, and she's got a laser dot on her forehead as he's coming towards her, and she's rescued in the nick of time by another time traveler. But like, boom, I mean, that there you go. That's an example of an element having to do with time travel, signaling that a dream is precognitive. And in this case, you know, what is Arnold Schwarzenegger but a time traveling hunter, okay? Going back in time to kill a prey, all right? Using a gun that has a laser dot. So I realize as I'm reading this, as I'm like looking at my dream description in my dream journal side by side with this picture, I'm realizing that the hunter, you know, the out of sight hunter in my dream was me at that time. Me, you know, 12 hours later in my timeline, hunting, you know, essentially, you know, being a time traveler in my past from that point of view. And it was a symbolic representation. I mean, dreams use symbolism. They pull associations from our lifetime of watching movies and whatever to symbolize things. And so it was a representation of my look back. This is why I call my clever title for that chapter is Look Back in Amber. It's like your look back, my look back in time, trapped in amber, essentially trapped in a fossil almost, that looking at that dream. And it can give you vertigo to have these experiences. It's one thing to recognize that a dream is precognitive, but often we don't recognize it at the moment that the event is happening. Often it's like in hindsight, but when you recognize it when it's actually happening, and can like refer to your dream journal and see that there's actually symbolism. Your dream captured you in the future, looking back at the dream as part of the event. It's mind blowing to experience this. But it's common when you start doing precognitive dream work. And that's why I really compare dreams to wormholes. They're essentially wormholes that bring two points in your life biography, bring them together. For a brief kind of blurry moment. It's like, it's, you know, you, it's not, it's symbolic. It's symbolically mediated, but it sort of folds the space-time of your biography for a moment. And that's why precognitive dream work is so exciting, to give you these experiences.
Why do we do it? Why did you have some inner need perhaps to see that? This is the question that goes back in my mind to Elizabeth Crone's experience and so many other experiences like this of why was she made to be helpless in an airplane watching a beautiful little boy and his mother be carried to their death? And what was the point? And in this case, why did you do that? I can understand that when I was taken back into my babyhood, it was a communication and a very clear one. The entity that I had failed to connect with because I was too scared was telling me that I was just taking baby steps, that I was still a baby. I understood that. But why did this happen to you?
Dreams bring us information. They bring us rewards, mostly, in our future. Okay, they bring us, and that was an incredibly rewarding experience. I mean, what I've just described to you was this incredibly rewarding, mind-blowing experience for me. And it was an experience that that was centered on things that were very important symbolically to me, including dinosaurs, which are very important for my childhood. The whole reason I subscribed to that magazine was I was trying to get in touch with my own childhood in the context of having my own small child, who's just old enough to, I want her to get into dinosaurs the way I was into dinosaurs.
Why are so many people into dinosaurs?
Well, they're...
Did they live then? Hmm? Do you suppose you lived in that world at some point? And how old are we?
No, they're just incredibly inspiring. I mean, that's one of the most, the most inspiring kind of sublime thoughts I had as a child was like wrapping my head around, these amazing animals that lived millions of years ago. I mean, and that's, that's stretching the mind, those sublime, thoughts, stretch your imagination and stretch your mind. And they're very important in our childhood to have those mind stretching thoughts. And I think that's why kids love dinosaurs. I mean, that's they're mind blowing and fun. And humans, we love turning animals into totems. This is a universal, cross culturally, all humans turn animals into, gods and tricksters and so on, figures in their mythology, and sort of we use animals to think with. This is this was a great insight. I don't know if it was his insight originally, but he sort of formulated this idea. Claude Lévi-Strauss, the French anthropologist, he talked about the elements of the natural world, like animals, plants, rocks, and so forth. They're symbols. They're symbols, and we use them to think about. We use them to philosophize, essentially. And dinosaurs are some of our most important totems. Unfortunately, we live in a world where the actual natural, the present day natural world is vanishing, and so many kids grow up, without having hardly any contact with the natural
world. Yeah. And many kids are furious about this. My grandkids, I know, are, they really, really are. I think the older generation is going to have a lot of trouble with the younger generation as they grow up deprived of things they should have had.
But anyway, dinosaurs represent that kind of lost ecology. They represent, for a little boy, T-Rex is this symbol of power. It's like a father figure kind of, there's all kinds of reasons we kids love dinosaurs.
How far back do you think we go as elements of reality?
I mean, I'm at the end of the day, I'm you'd probably consider me a boring materialist. I'm really interested in the scope of human evolution. We're a couple hundred thousand years. We have walked this earth and created the amazing things that we create and done the amazing things we do. I don't see us as having existence exactly preceding that, in some spiritual sense, but, that's enough for me. I mean, it's like, even one, this is why I'm not that interested, honestly, in past lives or reincarnation and stuff. Cause I think this life is so, if we focused on just this lifetime, it's, there's way more in this lifetime than we can ever understand. or an encompass. Like you were talking about going back to your childhood and seeing, like, you know, the
living. It wasn't seeing. I lived it. I lived those few moments.
Right. And when you do that and see, like, learn, you know, more than, you know, your brain can hold, you know, just from a moment in your own life. You know, I'm trying to get people to pay attention to their own lives in a new way and see how much there is there.
Yes. Well, free Dreamlanders, it's going to be time now for you to pay attention to your own life in the old fashioned way, because we've come to the end of the free part of Dreamland. How I wish you would be staying with us, and I do hope you make the decision to do that. Every week, a few of you make the decision to, yes, I'm going to do it, and very few ever cancel. We have just a tiny number of cancellations on the site. We've had more, of course, because of COVID, and that's been hard. But try it. Try going to unknown countries, subscribing, and listening to Eric Wargo's Time Loops interview and listening to the Elizabeth Crone interview. Those are just two of the many mind-bending interviews on unknowncountry.com. Eric's new book is Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self, Interpreting Messages from Your Future. And when we come back, subscribers, we're going to be talking about why we would be messaging ourselves from the future and how to make that practice work and unfold in your life. And I'm also going to be asking about physical movement through time. And I don't know how Eric regards that, but since it is happened to me, I'm really interested in the response of someone so clued in on the real journey of space-time. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us. Eric's book, I think I've already mentioned it, Precognitive Dreamworks. His blog is The Nightshirt.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.